What do you do if you're a dad out in public and your baby needs a diaper change?
Probably the first time I ever had to change my daughter out in public, there were no changing tables in the bathroom, and I ended up changing her behind a couch in the furniture section. So I'm sympathetic to the issue of changing tables and the plight of dads in bathrooms.
As Chicago dad Matt Barresi, we'll talk with him and learn about a new law signed by President Obama that's a small step towards potty parity. Also, how do you explain death to a four-year-old?
Obviously, I was upset when my grandmother died, and she noticed at dinner or whatever, like, Mom seems a little off. And, you know, I said, like, I lost someone close to me.
Illinois mom Stephanie Keene joins us to talk about tough conversations with kids. But first, as American companies shift towards cage-free eggs, animal advocates are asking, is cage-free farming really the more humane option? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks so much to Brian Moline for filling in for me for the past 2 days. And for all the Cubs fans out there, game two is tonight. Last week, members of Direct Action, an animal advocacy group, posted videos of cage-free barns in California showing the conditions in which those hens were being raised. It was at Pleasant Valley Farm, which produces eggs for Costco, one of the many companies that announced last year they were going cage-free for all of its procurement. The video showed disturbing images of injured chickens who were being pecked by others. We should point out that according to that same New York Times story, the farm said the animal rights group did not have permission to shoot the videos or to enter the farm. We're going to be talking about cage-free eggs right now. If you have a question about cage-free farming, you can join our conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. In studio with me in Urbana is Ken Kolkebeck. He's with the Illinois poultry industry. On the line from Northern Illinois is farmer Michelle Hill. She's got about 160 free-range chickens at her farm in Woodstock. And on the line from Washington is Craig Morris, who's deputy administrator at the Agricultural Marketing Service of the USDA. Ken, Michelle, Craig, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to start with that video we're talking about, which is pretty gruesome. As I mentioned, chickens being pecked in a horrific way. At one point, you see sort of like a headless carcass lying around. And I wanted to ask all of you sort of your reaction to the video in terms of if you think that's a common or if it's an accurate depiction of what happens in cage-free farming systems. Michelle, let me start with you. What do you think?
I do believe that that's an accurate description, just based solely on the fact that the chickens are not allowed to engage in their normal behaviors, foraging and dust bathing. They tend to become like any caged animal or any animal that is confined. They become aggressive, they become bored, and they will tend to turn on each other and show signs of stress, and they will pick on each other, they will peck at each other, and I think that's what you're witnessing in the video.
Ken, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to take a little bit opposite approach. I think that certain cage-free facilities, if managed properly, will not have the problems that were shown in that video. And that video, of course, picked out hens that were pecked at, and we've got to remember that the birds have to have adequate amount of feeder space, adequate amount of water, but they are a flocking creature. They like to stay together, and from time to time, if they aren't managed properly, if there's too much light in there, they are prone to pick at each other because they are kind of cannibalistic in nature, but I don't know if it's a really true accurate picture of all the cage-free facilities in the U.S. that we have now. It's just one that they had picked out.
Mm-hmm. Craig, what do you think? And what do we know about mortality rates in cage-free systems versus free-range or the traditional systems?
Well, I think the latter speaker was right. It's a different form of management required to have a cage-free operation than it is a battery-caged system. I think in proper management, we do a considerable amount of auditing for animal welfare requirements for companies that choose to have us do the auditing for them. And we find, in large measure, producers that are doing their best to manage that system properly, that video would not at all be typical of the way their eggs are produced. In terms of mortality, Cage-free is obviously the direction the industry is going. Today, we've got about 6% of the nation's egg layers in cage-free systems. By 2025, we're going to need to have about 74% of the nation's egg layers. And I think once the industry comes together, and we're working with the industry right now to come up with common industry standards for cage-free production, what would be the auditing systems to ensure that those production systems are being operated properly, being managed properly. I think as the industry becomes more adept at managing those systems, I think a lot of the things that we saw in that video will not be typical.
Can I ask, as we've talked about, because we mentioned three different things here, and Craig, I wonder if you can explain to us from the USDA's perspective, what is the difference between a cage-free system, a battery cage system, and free-range systems?
Well, battery caged is what we would today refer to as the conventional system. So that's the vast majority of conventional eggs are produced through battery cage systems. So in the United States, we've got some 276 million birds that are laying eggs right now. And in Illinois, you've got about 4.6 million of those. The vast majority of those today are in battery cage systems. And what those are literally wire cages where the birds, under industry standards, are afforded a certain number of square inches per bird, depending on whether or not they're a white layer or a brown layer, a variety of factors. The cage-free systems take a number of forms, and that's one of the issues that we're working with the industry now, that is a lot of retailers and other customers of the egg industry have made commitments to go cage-free. There's everything from aviary systems, which are, in effect, much larger cages, to barn systems where the birds are allowed to roam on the floor, to even certain systems that allow for a little bit of outdoor access. If you start talking about pasture-raised and those are much more of the idyllic green setting where the birds are outside doing a lot of those natural behaviors. I think the first speaker had talked about those would be much more emblematic of some of the organic settings, but clearly, much less density, a little higher, much higher cost of production.
And Michelle, I wonder if you can explain what you do. You are obviously at you're producing. You have about 160 chickens, right? So that's I think that's probably a pretty small system compared to the scale of volume of what we see, particularly in Illinois farms. How does it work on your farm?
We're definitely on the smaller side, but we have a relatively large coop that they go in to lay their eggs, their nesting boxes, and they sleep there at night. But in the morning, very early, about 5 o'clock, we open up the doors, and they are free to leave, and they basically roam the property. We have 10 acres for them, and they go everywhere. We have woods, we have a pond, we have fields for them to go in, and they go where they choose, and then they naturally will come back in at night and to lay their eggs. I mean, sometimes they hide them behind the barn or wherever, and then we close them in just to keep them safe from predators. And we do supplement them with feed, especially during the winter months. There's not much for them to range, but they are able to go out, come and go as they please.
Okay, so and then, Craig, to your mind, does the USDA have a definition for free range or pasture raised? How does the USDA regulate that?
Well, what we do here at USDA and egg regulation is actually a pretty complicated thing. There's a lot of shared responsibility between us and the Food and Drug Administration. On the case of labeling claims, so if somebody has a USDA graded egg that you'd see the USDA grade shield on, we ensure that any claim on that carton is accurate, that we actually verify that the farm that it's coming from has a standard behind that claim and that they're meeting the standard they've essentially set for themselves. We don't have required standards like we have for, like, let's say, organic, for things like pasture-raised or free-range. What we do is work with industry, and that's what we're right now working with the egg industry and their customers on, setting a standard for what is the industry standard for cage-free or minimum requirement, and that would be the standard that the industry would set for itself, and then we would verify if we were to see cartons of eggs that standard is at least being adhered to. But we don't have, like, certain programs like, again, organic would be one I talk about, and in certain other areas that we have marketing claims that are actually defined in regulation. Cage-free, those are not defined in regulation. The test we hold them to is essentially a truthful and not misleading standard. Just that the common person, would they believe that claim, if they understood the standard behind it, was truthful and not misleading.
Michelle, do you think that people are at that point now with understanding the differences? Do you think the average consumer gets that when they think about cage-free? Ken, I see you're already shaking your head here, so I'm going to ask you to weigh in a second. Michelle, what do you think about the average consumer, if there's a knowledge or understanding of what cage-free means versus, say, free-range?
I don't think that the average consumer knows the difference or can understand or probably hasn't researched the difference. You automatically in your head would think that cage-free is a step above the battery cages because, you know, the historic pictures of the battery cages are so deplorable looking, not knowing necessarily the natural behavior of chickens and that when these, sometimes cage-free operations, are overcrowded, that they do engage in behaviors that are cannibalistic or harmful and towards the other birds. And I don't think everybody knows that just because it's cage-free doesn't mean they have access to the outdoors or that they have sunlight or ventilation to the extent where they would if they were free-range.
Mm-hmm. And Ken, you agree with Michelle on the consumers not really understanding the difference.
Yes, I agree with Michelle. The cage-free system, it is a big cage because it is a big building, and the birds are inside the building. But in an organic situation, the birds are allowed to go outside on pasture or whatever. But the average consumer, I think, doesn't really know the difference. In fact, the industry is still struggling, as Craig said, that we're trying to define what a cage-free system is. And I think the average consumer would like to have affordable food products, of which the egg industry has done a great job of producing affordable eggs, and with a cage-free system and the need for, basically a lot more cage-free birds in by 2025, it's going to increase the price consumers pay and increase the cost for the industry, which is projected to be about $6 billion of added costs for production, those type of production facilities.
I want to get to the price and the market, and we've seen all of the announcements about Costco and McDonald's going to cage-free, and I want to get to that in a second, but I want to go back to something about the animal standards. And Michelle, you were talking about animal behavior of chickens in general. Craig, Ken, you're not just with the Illinois poultry industry. You also are a professor in the Department of Animal Sciences at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. I wonder if you can help us understand what... I don't know if there is sort of, if we even have a sense of what average chicken behavior is supposed to be, as we think about pecking and cannibalism and the things that we're seeing, not just in this video, but these other systems. Can you give us a little bit more perspective on that?
Well, chicken behavior, it's a pretty big topic, and a lot of people have studied that over the years. Of course, they are a flocking creature. They like to be together, but they are very social, interacting with their partners either in a cage or in a big cage or in a cage-free system. And
so there is literally a pecking order.
Yes, there is
whether
a pecking
or not
order.
You can't really mess with that.
That's correct. In a simple cage, whether you have seven or eight birds, you're going to have one bird at the top, and you're going to have two or three birds at the bottom. And the bird at the top, or a couple of birds at the top, are going to dominate the other birds every time the feeder comes on, drinking, and the space inside that cage. So there's going to be a smaller pecking order. Now, when you have thousands of birds in a cage-free system, you have a much larger pecking order, and you'll have more social interactions, and that will affect their productivity, their egg quality, mortality in that larger social structure, because they're a social creature.
And Michelle, I would imagine you would say that the pecking order among your chickens is probably a little more diffused because they have the ability to be with each other or be apart from each other. If there's a chicken that kind of wants to get out of that, it has an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, they definitely still maintain a pecking order, and there is certain on the lower end of the totem pole they will go to other parts of the property, and I do notice that the pecking order is worse in winter when they choose not to go outside as much, but they it doesn't seem like when they're confined they exhibit those behaviors much more. When they are out in the open, I rarely do see them trying to establish the pecking order. It's mostly when they're bored or they're confined because of the weather.
And Michelle, Ken mentioned egg quality. How long does it take? What's the average time it takes for your chickens to lay eggs?
When we hatch them from day-old chicks, we raise heritage breed chickens, and they usually don't start laying for anywhere between 5 and 7 months, depending on what time of year they were born. So it does take quite a while to feed them until you actually get your first egg return.
And then is that typical for most large scale operations as well?
Yes, they'll start from day one as a chick. They have to be raised and grown either in we have been doing it in cages quite a bit, but now we're going to try to raise them, I guess, in the cage free system in a rearing phase. But at about 18, 19 weeks of age, then they start into production at that point.
And what does it look like in Illinois? I know that Craig mentioned he mentioned cage-free operations in Illinois. When we look at from the Illinois Poultry Industry Council's perspective, what does the poultry egg laying industry look like here across the state?
Yes, we have six or seven large, what we call commercial size operations. The largest, I think, may have about 1.2 million birds on a production facility.
In one facility.
Yeah.
Wow.
But not one building,
but
one area.
But sure.
Yes, yes. But we have had increase in the southern part of the state of producers coming in, putting up floor-raised birds with about 25,000 birds in them. And then we have some of the producers that are actually putting up aviaries themselves, with much more birds in there. So, but the overall percentage of producers in the state producing cage-free eggs is still kind of down, kind of low. And I would think probably at least 75-80% of the bird population in the state are still raised in conventional cages.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Ken Kolkebeck. He's with the Illinois Poultry Industry Council. He also teaches in the Department of Animal Sciences. He's a poultry extension specialist at the University of Illinois. Michelle Hill is with us. She's the co-owner of Hill Bunker Farm in Woodstock up in northern Illinois, and on the line from Washington with the USDA, Craig Morris. If you have questions or comments, you can tweet them to 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. Tweet your questions or comments about cage-free eggs there. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455, and we'll pick up this conversation in just a minute. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about cage-free egg farming in Illinois and across the country. We've seen lots of big moves. McDonald's, Costco, many companies over the past year announcing that they're going to be going cage-free for their procurement processes. But we're also talking about what cage-free really means, if it's regulated or not. On the line with us from Washington with the USDA, Craig Morris has been explaining some of the industry standards to us. We've got Ken Kolkebeck in studio with me in Urbana. He's with the Illinois Poultry Industry Council. He also teaches in the Department of Animal Sciences at the University of Illinois. And on the line with us from Northern Illinois, from her farm in Woodstock, Hill Bunker Farm, is Michelle Hill, who's she's co-owner of the Hill Bunker Farm. Ken, I wanted to just ask you, because before the break you mentioned that most Illinois producers use battery cages. And I wonder if the reason that you're not seeing more shift in Illinois to cage-free farming systems, is it because of the cost? Is it because of the lack of industry standards? And maybe, as you said, maybe not as much awareness about how to manage a cage-free system versus the traditional battery cage system we've been talking about?
I think it's all of those factors you just mentioned. Management is a key issue, but the cost, if you're going to go, it's a big investment. If you're going to take cages out and put in a cage-free system, it's going to cost quite a bit of money. And then a producer has to figure out, okay, am I getting paid back for my investment? And so it's going to be consumer-driven, but it's also going to be the marketing. If they can't sell the cage-free eggs, then why change their system?
Mm-hmm. Michelle, how expensive would you, I don't know if you have a sense of how expensive it is for you to raise, you're a small scale operation, obviously, everything is free range. Do you have a sense of how much it costs for the eggs that you're producing?
We've been kind of keeping close tabs on it. When we started doing this because just this is what we love to do, but the eggs, we sell our eggs for $5 a dozen, and when we analyze yearly how much the feed cost us, how much it costs us for everything from the heater bulbs for the chicks, predator losses, we have those are large. You have, like I mentioned before, when they hide their eggs. When it comes down to it, I'm truly, it costs me about 4 $4.50 a dozen to produce these eggs, which is not accounting for my time for cleaning the coop and caring for the chickens, you know, twice a day on a daily basis. So I'm sure this would be easier on a larger scale. I think your profits get higher as your numbers do, but we're truly not in it for the money. Mm-hmm. It's very, very expensive. There's just so many factors and so many things that can go wrong when you're doing it like we are.
And Michelle mentioned that she's at about $5 a dozen. Craig, do we have a sense of what the average prices are right now for cage-free or for conventional? I know obviously prices can range, but can you give us a sense?
Yeah, we started actually publishing a weekly egg report for cage-free. We have for some time published prices on conventional eggs. We then started publishing prices, obviously, for organic eggs. California actually had its own market conditions established by a ballot initiative there where they changed their battery cage systems in what are called enriched colony cages, which also had a little different cost of production point. So we also started publishing a California price to represent the cost of production in California for their enriched colony cages. And now we've also started publishing the prices for the cage-free. Right now, we're not seeing as large of a difference because we have a pretty high oversupply of eggs at the moment. So this is probably not the most representative period that you would want to be looking at conventional egg prices, organic is kind of its own separate market right now. But right now, we're not seeing a huge difference between the conventional eggs and the cage-free, primarily because we have an oversupply of eggs at the moment.
Michelle, why do you think companies like McDonald's or Costco decided to shift to saying they're going to produce cage-free? Why do you think they chose cage-free and not free-range or pasture? Do you think this is marketing? Do you think this is money? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think it's probably a public relations issue that they've probably received feedback that, you know, as we said before, most of the public believes that, you know, cage-free is a more humane option. But in reality, I don't think consumers would be paying for an Egg McMuffin that was made with a free-range egg that costs as much as it does, at least at this point in time. And I think most of the public, you know, isn't going to spend $5 a dozen for free-range eggs. But that's probably why the large companies are going towards the cage-free, because it does makes it sound like they're listening to what the consumers want.
Ken, do you think cage-free is more humane than the traditional system?
Well, that's debatable, but in the long run, when you look at production, mortality in these cage-free systems, the stress from disease exposure, parasites, if we qualify and we say it's humane for that type of system, then I would say not. But then there are probably some good systems out there that don't have those problems, no disease problems, and that would be so they're variable on both sides of the issue, I guess in my opinion I would say that overall they're probably maybe about the same. About the same. But it depends on what you're looking at. If you're looking at their behavior, sure, they have a lot better behavior, more freedom of movement in cage-free than to do cages. And if that's how we've defined poultry welfare, laying in welfare, then yeah, the cage-free system would be better. But we also got to look at production, egg quality, and some of these other things that would probably negate that.
Craig, what's next for the USDA in terms of addressing consumer confusion around this? Because I think as we've kind of laid out here, I think it's not quite clear for the average consumer what cage-free actually means.
Our primary focus right now is helping the industry with an orderly transition. The secretary had pulled in the major retailers and buyers of eggs, as well as the representatives of the egg industry, to say, if we're going to get from where we are today with about 6% of the birds in cage-free systems to by 2025 having 74% of the birds in cage-free systems, that's a huge investment that the industry needs to make. The other speaker had already mentioned the $6 billion number that's been thrown out, which is certainly on the lower end of the estimates that we have before us. Where are producers going to come up with that capital? And the big challenge that they have is going to their lending institutions. Most of the aid companies in the United States are family farms. They're going to have to take a loan out to make sure that they have the cost or the money's available to make the investment in the cage-free system. Before they can take that loan out, they have to know that their customer agrees with them and what the standard for cage-free is. So right now, our primary focus is sitting down and establishing an industry standard for cage-free that all of those that have made the commitments, the Costcos and those that you had mentioned, can augment the statements that they've already made that this is the system that they're talking about when they use the term cage-free. And then producers know they have a solid platform to make their investment on that they know their customer is going to be content with the eggs that come out of that system. So our primary focus right now is developing the standard with the industry so that everyone can have confidence that by 2025, this is the system we're talking about. The big issue we have now, though, is because egg prices are so low, there's not a lot of extra capital floating around for people to make those investments. Mm-hmm. And so we need to work on ways to encourage demand for cage-free between now and 2025 so that producers that choose to make that investment to go cage-free today can realize some form of return on their investment, because once 74% of the industry is cage-free, again, the market forces are going to make that system of production very cost competitive, and you know, more than likely we're going to have a lot of people that are currently in the egg business that are going to have to exit.
Thanks to Craig Morris. He's a deputy administrator with the Agricultural Marketing Service at the USDA, joining us from Washington. Thanks also to Michelle Hill, co-owner of Hill Bunker Farm in Woodstock, and Ken Kokobek with the Illinois Poultry Industry Council. He also teaches in the Department of Animal Services at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What do you do if you're out in public with their baby and you need a diaper change, but there's no changing tables in the bathroom? Dads in this situation may have no choice but to change their baby's diaper on the floor or behind the couch in a busy department store. That's what happened to Matt Baresi when he was shopping at a department store with his daughter. He's a Chicago dad and co-creator, along with two of his former roommates from college, of a podcast all about fatherhood. It's called The Paternity Test. He's on the line with us from Chicago now to talk about the plight of dads in bathrooms and discuss a new law that takes a small step towards potty parity. Hey, Matt, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So I imagine that was quite of an entree into fatherhood, having to change your baby's diaper on the floor behind a couch at Macy's.
It was a trial by fire. Well, not fire, something more pungent than fire, but it let me know life was going to be different from now on.
Is it common for you to be in situations where there aren't changing tables in men's bathrooms?
It is common. It's common for there to be no changing station, and also sometimes just for the bathrooms to be too foul to use, even if there is a changing station. Even though the number of men taken care of, either primarily or substantially taking care of their kids, is skyrocketing, you often find yourself either with no changing table, or whether it's because of the general boorishness of men or the anatomy of men, the bathrooms are often so messy that to take a child in there or to change a baby seems really, really unpleasant. And you really wish there was either preferably a family station, a family restroom, a separate restroom, rather than the men's room.
Right. And I know part of the reason we're talking about this is because a few weeks ago, President Obama signed the Babies Act. It stands for Bathrooms Accessible in Every Situation, and it requires baby changing stations to be available at all restrooms in publicly accessible federal buildings. I imagine you think this is at least a step in the right direction.
I think it's a great message. I mean, how many people will it truly impact only being in, it's in federal buildings, and federal buildings that don't already have an accessible restroom on the same floor.
Right, so it has to be publicly accessible.
Also,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, right. So there might be a handicap restroom or a family restroom on that floor. And if there's not, then there definitely needs to be a changing station in the men's room. So you might not always find yourself in a federal building, a post office, a DMV, needing to change a baby. You will sometimes. But I think the important thing about the bill passing is that it sends a message to corporate chains and even to mom and pops that this is the reality of things now, that men are carrying babies, they need to change them, and that hopefully voluntarily, places that aren't under the mandate of the, or under the dictate of the federal law, will step to the fore and think about their customers and put in changing tables as well.
And I mean, Matt, we were talking to you about, you host the podcast, The Paternity Test. What have you heard from other dads about this issue, particularly with changing tables in bathrooms?
It's an issue. It's an issue, you know, it's most commonly an issue with mom and pop places or with small places, boutique businesses, places in little towns or in cities where, you know, I imagine that the operating margins are pretty small. So they're in a no frills kind of place, small bathrooms. And so there's no changing table in the men's room. And that you'll almost never find a changing table there. And then when you get into larger places, commercial places, it's hit or miss. And it's always, I mean, you think, well, just figure it out. But really, there are no other surfaces except for a dirty sink with no real lip on it to change the baby. And then that puts you out in the store with, like, with a dirty, naked child. And you're up a creek in a hurry. I was looking on some web pages of some companies. Last year, there was a change.org petition started by Ashton Kutcher. And both Ashton Kutcher and change.org are kind of silly entities more often than not, but they were pushing for big chains to make sure there were always changing stations in men's rooms. And Target and Costco answered that petition and said most of our stores already do, and we pledge that going forward all new stores will.
Well, they also have family restrooms too, right? Most of those stores have, right?
Yeah, and most new big box stores are going to have a family restroom, which is also fine. But sometimes when you find yourself in an older store, you're out of luck, and it's very unfortunate. And I gather now I don't frequent ladies' rooms, but I gather it's a much more common occurrence for there to be a changing station in the ladies' room.
I can tell you confidently from my experience of being a lady for a long time, yes, there's almost always a changing table in the women's bathroom. They're also bigger. There's normally just always more space in a women's bathroom, which from my understanding of conversations with people about what men's rooms are like, which I have no experience with. So, but I wonder, I mean, do you think this is part of a larger issue? I think it sort of reflects that everyone still sort of sees women as the only one who are taking care of babies?
I think it's very true. And when you look at statistics, when you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and you look at Pew Research, the numbers, it is clearly true that more men are staying home. Those numbers are muddied by the fact that some are not choosing to stay home. Post the Great Recession, the number of stay-at-home men went up. But that's not to say that they were choosing to take care of the kid. But we also know that the number of men choosing to stay home and take care of their kids has gone up, has really gone up in the last 10 years to about 21% of the caretaking parents are now men. But attitudinally, I don't think that's the case. And where my co-hosts and my friends and a lot of our listeners have noticed it is in medical care. When you're at the hospital for maybe for delivery, when you're in fertility clinics, as so many of us are in with our wives, that the doctors and the nurses literally orient their bodies away from you when they're talking to, and they just talk to your wife. Some of that may be legal, that if the wife is the patient by name, that they're trying to share with just the patient. But when you're there as the father, and sometimes, you know, your wife may be medicated or sedated, and you really need to be the one absorbing the information, there's definitely a prejudice out there that men are along for the ride, or, you know, we're all dopey sitcom dads who can't quite handle the information.
Don't know how to change diapers. Right.
Exactly. And it's just not the case. We're changing the diapers, we're managing the medicines, and we need all the info.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation because you're dealing with this. You're not a stay-at-home dad. I feel like I should point this out. You're not a stay-at-home dad. This is still a very important part of your life, parenting and changing diapers in a bathroom, even though you're not necessarily the primary caregiver of your daughter. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Matt Barresi. He's host of the podcast, The Paternity Test, on the line with us from Chicago. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
We'll be right back.
for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking dads, daughters, bathrooms. Earlier this month, President Obama signed the Babies Act. Had bipartisan support, by the way. It stands for Bathrooms Accessible in Every Situation and requires baby changing stations to be available in all restrooms in publicly accessible federal buildings. We're talking about that being a step forward for the plight of dads in bathrooms and potty parity. Matt Barresi is my guest. He's host of the podcast, The Paternity Test. And Matt, your daughter's not a baby anymore. She's five. And just think about this. There's a Louis C.K. sketch about him trying to, completely inappropriate for us to play on airwaves, but he describes the time he had when he had to take his daughters into a bathroom at JFK, the men's restroom. And I know this is a big issue for you now. You have a five-year-old. I mean, maybe you can describe for us the dilemma that you face if you're out with your daughter and she needs to go to the bathroom.
Sure. I think the dilemma has actually gotten worse since the changing table situation. Then, if there was no changing table, you had to ask around while you had this, a baby with an exploded diaper. You had to go find an associate and say, where can I find a changing table? Or you had to duck behind a couch. But it was a percentage of the time. You know, it was maybe half the time, 60% of the time. And you were a man with a baby, so everybody thought, everything you did was adorable and you looked flailing and helpless in a good way. It's gotten more challenging now with a toddler and a preschooler, or as my daughter has gone through the stages of toddler to preschooler. Now she's still too young to send off to the ladies' room by herself. I'm with her frequently by the nature of my job being in, I'm an academic and in the media, so my hours are strange, which means I spend time with her during the day and more than maybe a 9-to-5er might. So there we are. We're in a store. She needs to go to the bathroom. The kids have to go potty a lot. They either forget to go or don't go all the way, but they sure go frequently. And you've got now what are your choices? You can't send her alone into the ladies' room. If you take her into the men's room, one, it's usually just an absolute disaster in there. And there are men there, and there are urinals in there, which there are men that are fairly exposed and get self-conscious when a girl walks in. And then you have this.
Well, and she's probably also asking you questions, right?
Yeah. She sure is. I mean, she has an active desire to understand where all the parts are and what they're called and who's got what. So she'll be talking full voice about, what are those guys over there holding and what's happening in this room. And it doesn't work for anybody.
So I mean, how do you resolve this? Because it's the tough thing. If there's not a family bathroom, she's not at an age where you can send her into a restroom by herself, obviously, especially if you're in a public place. How do you solve this?
Well, I don't know if there's any perfect solutions. One way is to peek your head in and see if there's anybody in the men's room. And if there's not, then you go in. And if there is, you wait. But frequently, if you're in a big place, there's never a time when the restroom is empty. And in that case, you have to stay low and go. You just have to sort of bundle your child in and quickly to a stall, hope that there isn't a murder scene in that stall, and get done what needs to be done, and then sort of bundle her back out quickly.
Do you feel like on the Paternity Test as a podcast, do you feel like there's enough advocacy for dads in the situation that you're in? Do you think enough people are talking about the plight that you are probably facing with your daughter every day?
Well, it's not – what I do understand is that it's not – when you're talking about something like big infrastructure, like adding a family bathroom to businesses, putting a changing table on the wall, those are cheap. They're plastic. They have a painting of a koala on the side. You grab two bolts and you go in and you got a changing table. So that should be no big deal. Everybody should have those. Adding a family bathroom, which is the – a family restroom is the ideal – that's some pretty major infrastructure. So I don't know that it's that there's no advocacy out there so much as that it's going to take a lot of time and money for there to be such a big shift in habits as to have most businesses have family restrooms.
Mm-hmm. Do you just kind of know the places that you can go with her? Like, do you just think, okay, I'm going to go to a Starbucks because it's going to be a single bathroom where we can just go in and no one else is going to be in there? Do you kind of have all of those places scoped out in Chicago or wherever you are with her?
You sure do. I remember when I was childless, but I lived in New York for a time. It's less true in Chicago, but also true in Chicago. You become acutely aware of where there are accessible and safe bathrooms because it's hard to find a bathroom in a city where security is higher. Once you have a kid, no matter where you live, I think you immediately find out what's where the friendly potties are. Unfortunately, it often drives you to more corporate places if that's not your speed. You know, if you try to consciously stay away from chains, and I don't
right,
know
but you know that you can take her to Target or Starbucks because you know exactly what
Target's
the bathroom.
Always good. Starbucks is like, I feel like Starbucks' popularity is based 95% on the fact that they have an accessible and typically clean bathroom in any city in the country. Barnes & Noble is a great place to find a bathroom that, you know, your kid won't be scarred for life if you take them to the bathroom. So, yeah, you find out in a hurry where you can take them and not have to explain, go too deeply into the birds and the bees and human plumbing.
So, Matt, my last question for you, because we talked about, you know, we've talked about the statistics of how many more stay-at-home dads there are. You've pointed out you are not yourself necessarily a stay-at-home dad. You're just sharing a lot of the caregiving with your wife because of your schedules, both of you being academic professionals. I guess I would ask, are you frustrated? Do you feel like society is lagging behind in terms of support for or respect for dads in general?
I think there's a friendliness. I think that people know that dads are new to this in a way, even though that's maybe not just. It's true that men are just getting on board the parenting their own children wagon. So I think that there's a warmth shown by passersby, like when they see you changing your child behind a couch or your kid melting down in a hardware store or at a Comic-Con or wherever previously dads wouldn't have a kid. I think people try to be helpful. So I think attitudinally, as a country, we're friendly towards dads. I think it's more systematically in places where dads are now more present in pediatricians' offices, in OBGYN and fertility situations, in clothing boutiques, in places that have previously been the realm of women. I think there is not an immediate tendency to greet the dad, engage the dad, and speak to the dad. So that's where the change needs to come.
Matt Barresi is co-host of the Paternity Test Comedy Podcast. It's about the frustrations and absurdities of fatherhood. He's also the author of the award-winning weekly Paternity Test blog. You can find him at chicagoparent.com. He also does a monthly column, Viva Daddy, in Chicago Parent Magazine. Matt, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. How do you explain death to a four-year-old? That's a question that Chicago mom Stephanie Keene was faced with when her grandmother passed away and her four-year-old wanted to know what happened. Stephanie is a freelance writer whose recent article for the women's website She Knows was all about her experience talking about death with her preschool-age daughter. She's on the line with us from Chicago. Stephanie, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Yeah, thanks, Nyla. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, your grandmother passed away in 2015. Your daughter Hannah was four, and you went together to her memorial service. And I know it was sort of even a question that most parents have at that age. What part of the services do we involve our child in? How did you make that decision in terms of should we bring her to the memorial service? Maybe not the funeral, but then I guess your daughter's probably wondering, like, where's grandma when she gets to her grandmother's house?
Right. So she was actually, that happened about a month before she turned four. So she was actually about three when all of this happened. And to give you some context, my family does not live here in Chicago with us. My parents live in Florida. My extended family lives all over northern Wisconsin. So when it came to the memorial service, my husband and I went up to it together. It was in northern Wisconsin. And so we had decided we would bring her with us for the weekend. I had been asked to give one of the eulogies at my grandmother's service. And we decided to not take her to the funeral, but obviously she was going to notice that all of a sudden she was surrounded by all of this family that she doesn't see that often. And we would also be going back to my grandmother's cottage and she would notice that my grandmother wasn't there. So we had made the decision we would bring her with us for the weekend. We would answer any questions she had. but we weren't going to take her to the service. And my thinking on that, honestly, my first thought was I just didn't think she could sit still that long. You know, that really had a lot to do with why I decided not to take her. It was in March in northern Wisconsin, so it was really just a service. There wasn't anything graveside or anything involving the body, so that made it a lot easier to make that decision as well.
And how did you explain to her that her great-grandmother, your grandmother, wasn't around anymore? What did you actually say?
She kind of brought it up, like, and my husband and I had kind of talked in advance, like any good parenting decision, I found that having a pre-game plan, works out well. And so, she said, you know, why isn't great grandma here? And I said, well, you know, she has died. What that means is she's not here with us anymore. And I explained that, she had gotten sick. My grandmother had had a stroke and then died after a brief illness following stroke. I didn't go into any of that because I didn't really think she needed that level of detail. But I said, you know, sometimes you get sick and it's just a little cold and you get better. And sometimes people get sick and it's something more serious and they don't really get better. And, you know, they stop being alive. You know, they stop breathing. They, you know, and the important thing is for us to think about the time we had with her and, you know, how important she was to us and how much we loved her and appreciate those good times. So we try to put a lot of it in context of what she would understand. Like, you know, one of the things I said was, you know, you're not going to see her anymore. She's not going to be able to talk to us. She's not going to be able to give you hugs. And I think that sort of talking to her about it at her level really helped her sort of engage with it a little bit.
And then maybe it was sort of like you thought she was engaged and then you're like, okay, she gets it. And then she came to you a little bit after that with a towel. What did she say to you?
So she brought me, I was a couple months later my parents had just finished going through my grandmother's cottage and had brought us a couple of keepsakes. And so I know exactly what this is inspired by. So she had this towel that she'd received as a gift that was one of her favorite things. And I was cooking dinner and she brought the towel to me and she said, Mom, I want you to have this towel so that you and Dad could remember me after I die. And, you know, I sort of, you know, that staggered me a little bit because on the one hand, I felt like I was kind of stunned this occurred to her. On the other hand, I also felt like, well, that's a really nice thing to offer. You know, it's kind of one of those things when you have kids, you know, they can break your heart while also filling you with a tremendous amount of pride at the same time. So I said, I was like, you know, buddy, I know this towel is very important to you. I really appreciate you offering it to me. But I'm not going to die today. You're not going to die today. You're probably not going to die anytime soon. And I promise you, you know, if somehow your dad and I outlive you, which I don't think is very likely, we will remember everything about you and we will take good care of your towel. But I don't think that's something you need to worry about. And you can go ahead and hang on to it for now.
And it's interesting to hear how kids internalize that message, because then not long after all of this, your dog died. And how did Hannah respond to that?
You know, she took it really, really well. And I think some of it was because of the discussions we had after my grandmother died. I mean, obviously, our dog was a constant daily presence in her life. My grandmother was someone she saw, you know, once or twice a year. So she, you know, the day it happened, we kind of sat down. And again, we explained it in a way that was age appropriate. I didn't feel like she would understand the concept of euthanasia, but she did definitely understand, you know, the dog got sick. We took her to the vet. While she was at the vet, she died. And, you know, we cried. We both cried. And we talked about how much we'd miss her. And then the next day, I took her out for ice cream. It was summer by this point. And on our way there, we saw, I live in Andersonville, if you're familiar with Chicago. But it's a neighborhood with a lot of outdoor space and patios. And we saw someone outside the ice cream place with their dog. It was this beautiful white shaggy dog, and Hannah went over and said, you know, can I pet your dog? And started petting her and sort of looked up at the owner and said, you know, my dog Sophie, she died yesterday. And the owner said, oh, well, you must be very sad. And Hannah said, yeah, I am, but it's okay. You know, she was very sick and we'll hold her in our hearts forever. And, you know, I found that on one level, it was, you know, I found it very charming.
Yeah, such a, yeah, Stephanie, it's such a, appreciate that. Yeah, such a sweet story. I'm afraid we're out of time, but thanks for sharing that. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.